Good afternoon. It's 5 minutes after 1 o'clock on Monday, March 10th. Call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. Present today with us is a full House: Representative Johnson, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Hawker, Coach Vice Chair Wilson, Co-Chair Feige, Representative Olson, Representative Tarr, Representative Seaton, and myself, Co-Chair Sadler. See no other members except for Representative Lance Pruitt in the audience. Encourage members to kill your cell phones. And Representative Herring, I'm sorry, you're so my traveling companion there. Sorry, Representative Herring. Gotta watch out for the quiet ones, absolutely. We do have two bills on the agenda today. House Bill 344, Oil and Gas Transferable Tax Credit Certificate. And House, I'm sorry, 334? And HJR 30, Eisenbeck Land Exchange. We did have two bills pulled from the agenda at the request of each bill's sponsor. That's House Bill 344, Invasive Aquatic Plant Species Control, and House Bill 351, Uses of Nancy Lake State Recreation Area. Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just like a request that we have an explanation of why 344 was pulled.
Thank you, Representative Feige. We have just the man to do it. Representative Olson.
Oh, thank you, Coach. This is one of the times when government works fast. DNR issued a quarantine notice on the aquatic plants that we were having problems with, and permitted the we can no longer import, sale, or distribute Ebola.
Elodia.
We have about three things that are similar, and went into effect immediately. So there was no reason to go forward with the bill because they were able to move so fast, and pleased or not, we saved the state a little bit of money by doing it that way.
That is timely. Answer your question, sir?
Yeah.
Very good.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was kind of looking forward to hearing this because we've had some concern about floatplanes, and when you say quarantine, I have spoken with the department, and it is not their intention to keep floatplanes from flying in and out of lakes that may or may not have this plant in there. So I just want to be clear that for my office working on it, Campbell Lake is in my district, that when you say quarantine, that doesn't mean that you'll still be able to land your airplane, as opposed to having someone import, sell, and otherwise. So I just want to be clear on that, and we're working with the department to clarify that quarantine doesn't mean quarantine.
I'm glad to get that clearly in the record.
Thank you.
Other points on HB 344? Seeing none on that, I would invite the sponsor of House Bill 334 and or his staff to come to the podium and give us their initial presentation on the legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you're ready, I'll
proceed. For the record,
Before we proceed, which version of the bill are we... Do we have before us?
We're just going to get to that. Representative Pruitt, we do have the original version of the bill in on file and a work draft presented, so if you'd help the committee understand which version of the bill you're speaking to in your initial statement, that would be helpful.
I'll be speaking to the work draft, which would be you. Hope everyone has.
For the record, that's work draft 28LS1407/U for uniform. So.
All right.
Proceed, sir.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lance Pruitt, I represent District 25, which is in East Anchorage. And thank you for hearing HB 334. To give you an understanding of kind of where the genesis of this bill came from, go back to this summer. I had the opportunity to go down to Ketchikan and visit the fair city of Representative Wilson. And they gave me a chance to see quite a few things, but one of the things was, of course, the shipyard, the Alaska Shipping Dry Dock down there. In discussions with some of their leadership in a meeting that I had, recognized that we had a tax credit that we had put in place, our manufacturing tax credit, in SB 21 last year, that they were not able to utilize, and rightly so, to tell you the truth. They weren't able to utilize it due to the requirement that they be a taxpayer. And so I took that information back, and trying to because I thought it was intriguing. I felt that it was important to allow the facility that both the state owns, as ADA owns the actual yard itself, as well as the fact that there are people employed there, Alaskans employed there, how we could facilitate getting them the opportunity to participate in the SB 21 tax credit that we had placed in there. Went back and talked to the Department of Revenue, and actually many of you know Mike Pulowski Fish, and he had a novel idea to make it work without it becoming essentially, for lack of a better term, essentially not become another film tax credit where we are actually paying out money to someone who is not actually a taxpayer to the state. And we've gone back and forth, hence the reason why you have a work draft with some changes from before, trying to see how this could appropriately be applied. And what we have come up with at this point in time is a credit that would be essentially applied to the property tax on the asset itself by the owner. And I'm kind of oversimplifying that, but what the idea would be, they could take a credit over 5 years. It cannot reduce their tax to lower than zero, so we're not going to be paying them, but they are able to apply it towards their state property tax with the option of the municipalities allowing it as well. So say, for instance, the Seward, the dry dock down there, if they chose to participate as well and determine that they wanted to also allow for certain things to be manufactured there, that it could apply there, and I could see potentially the Kenai Peninsula Borough being interested, as some of these potentially would be in their waters or in their area where they have some of their purview, that they could apply it. So we wanted to make sure that the option was available for these municipalities to apply it as well. So that's kind of the real simple, down and dirty, kind of how it came about, what the goal is. The goal here is to make sure that as many Alaskans can participate in the what I see as the renaissance coming from SB 21 and have that opportunity to bring the manufacturing back home to Alaskans specifically, as well as to Alaska with an asset that we have invested a lot of time and money in down there in the dry dock there, the shipyard down there in Ketchikan.
Okay. Thank you. At this point, I guess I would entertain a motion to adopt the version uniform as our working document. Representative Seaton.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt version U as our working document.
No objection. We now have version 28LS1407/uniform as our working CS for 334. Questions for the sponsor?
And if there's any questions in kind of some of the technical, I have myself obviously here, but Dirk Kraft from my office. We have with us as well several of the people from Vigor, including Doug Ward, and I think Mark Hickey. There's a couple of them back there, and they should be also available to answer some questions.
Thank you. And for the record, I should also know we have a couple folks online to answer questions. Emily Naumann with Ledge Legal is online, and Matt Fonder with Department of Revenue could answer revenue questions. I've got Representative P. Wilson and then Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just wanted to maybe perhaps make this a little bit clearer. In that bill, it was acknowledged that a lot of times when the producers up in the North Slope needed different items, that they would go to the Lower 48 or even another country and have them built and then ship them back up here, and we wanted wanted there to be an incentive so that people in Alaska would be able to get jobs from that, and so that's what it started out in Senate Bill 21, so that we could, in fact, if they were produced in Alaska, that the company would get a tax break because of that, and so that's kind of where we're using that as a template to get started. So,
thank you, Representative Harper.
Okay, thank you. If you don't mind, I've got just a couple of. I mean, it's judgment calls in the bill. Just a couple of questions, and maybe first is we're taking a credit that currently applies against corporate income tax by the person who actually spent the original money to develop the improvements to the tangible personal property. That's the 43-20-049. but we're allowing it to be a transferable tax credit that can be applied against taxes under 4356. We've moved it over to the property tax section.
Right.
Curiosity, why have we taken it to the property tax section? And frankly, if we really want this to be utilized, why don't we allow it to be utilized more broadly and say perhaps both the someone with corporate income tax liabilities, production tax liabilities, or property tax liabilities?
We actually have the right person to answer that. It should be online. Nauman? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think
that's right. Emily Nauman, if you're on the line, can hear us and can respond to Representative Hawker's question.
Yeah, that's complete. Sorry, this is through the chair. This is Emily Nauman. I'm Legislative Legal Services. Representative Hawker, that's just completely a policy call.
Thank you.
There's no legal implications either way.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And if I may ask a follow-on question, sir?
Yes, you may. Representative Hawker.
My other goes back to the difference between version A and version U of the bill. Version A provided that the credit certificate could only be transferred to the initial purchaser of the tangible personal property that was the basis for generating that credit. In other words, I contract with you, you build my module, I am the one that can get that. You've broadened that up substantially by allowing it to be traded basically freely on the open market. Is that, what prompted you to change that provision within the two drafts?
Mr. Chair, if I may, Dirk Kraft, staff to Representative Lance Pruitt. Initially, we had that in there, and it was, like you said, very limiting, Representative Hawker, but we took it out because we did want to broaden that up and make it more applicable to anyone who's associated with that property. And I think, as I understand it, it's still limited to people associated as we wrote it in version U.
Actually, your comment just stated something on the record that I'm not sure is in the statute. A person that is entitled to take a credit, if I might cite, sir.
Certainly, read ahead.
I'm reading the 4320.052 amendment, the new section. A person who is entitled to take a credit under 4320.049 and wishes to transfer the unused credit to another person and may apply for a transferable certificate. And I don't believe there's any restriction on that other person definition. Is that my correct understanding?
Through the chair, you're correct.
Okay, thank you.
That was Dirk Kraft responding. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Reason for this to go against property tax instead of corporate income tax, I'm trying to figure out why we would do that if we're just making it transferable to anybody that's paying property tax across the state. It doesn't relate to the area where the construction is. It could be anybody that has property tax liability, I guess. Am I reading that correctly?
Representative Pruitt, I'm trying to make sure that I appropriately answer your question. Let me go back to the genesis of it. As the genesis of why property tax was actually a suggestion that came from Mike Pelosi, how we could make it actually apply. There was concern that we would get ourselves lost in the corporate tax piece of it because of the fact the transferability and the limiting of it. We didn't want to create another film tax credit, essentially what it came down to. We were trying to find a place where we could actually apply it where there might be an actual corporate income tax liability. That's, for example, you could have potentially a company who is an LLC that has purchased this product that's actually in the service industry that's utilizing this, let's say in Cook Inlet, for example. They might not have a corporate tax liability. So instead, because we don't want we want the credit to be able to apply, and we also don't want it to turn into a situation where they have a zero tax liability, and so we're actually paying them, we felt that it was probably appropriate to make sure that we apply it to something that they will have to pay taxes on, which would be property taxes. So it was a way of putting under the umbrella everyone, not just the major players, so you know we automatically think of the people who are going to be invested in it, but also the service industry individuals who might be the ones actually owning this asset and may not have a tax liability. How do we allow them to be able to utilize this credit and apply it towards something that they do have a tax liability, which it would be property taxes, the assets that they own?
Hello, Representative Hume.
Thank you. I'm trying to figure out, because it seems like it's so broadly applied that it doesn't have anything to do with who owns the asset or anything else. It's a tax credit is given to somebody that builds something, and then they, if they don't have corporate tax credits, they transfer it to somebody that has corporate tax credits or, I mean, corporate taxes.
Yeah.
And in this case, we're allowing it to be applied to anyone that has property tax. But I don't see it just being applied to oil and gas properties. Is this only oil and gas properties, or is this going to be other properties as well?
No, appreciate it. Representative Pruitt again. The intent was to apply it towards oil and gas. The intent was to make sure that they were able to participate in, of course, the credit that was under SB 21, and it's kind of evolved from there, to tell you the truth. As we started looking at that particular credit, we recognized some of the limitations that existed. The intent, though, from my end, was that it would be oil and gas development that they could be able to participate in. It's a policy call of whether we want to go beyond that, but I think that it's important to make sure that the people in Southeast, the people in Seward, they have ability to tag on to and be a part of the oil development that takes place in parts of the state that they may not be necessarily associated with.
To clarify that, Representative Harker, just a clarification at this point.
And just a point of clarification that as written, as I read this, /U allows the credit to be applied against the tax levied under AS 43.56. And 43.56, and a kind of a key point here is that it's the chapter title is Oil and Gas Exploration, Production, and Pipeline Transportation Property Taxes. So that's really the broad scope. It would keep it within that industry, but it's not just exploration, it's not just production. It includes pipeline transportation.
Right.
Going back to that point, and that Representative Seaton got Kawasaki up.
Thank you. And I guess I'm trying to figure out, we were giving a tax credit to somebody building modules.
Mm-hmm.
But as I read this, they can't take the tax credit at all. They will have to transfer it because in most cases they will not have oil facilities and transportation credit, so no longer is it a tax credit to the person that is building the facilities. It's simply a tax credit that has to be transferred to an oil company or someone that has pipeline taxes. Is that the intent of this bill?
I think if I understand you correctly, that yes, that is the intent is to, because Vigor and because the Alaska Ship and Dry Dock do not have a tax liability to the state, which is to your initial point that it would be the one producing it, to make this transferable to the individual who has asked them to produce this product, either the third, either the supplier, oil and gas supply company, or maybe even the company itself, to be able to utilize this credit.
Thank you, Representative Pruitt. Representative Kawasaki.
Just sort of along the same lines of questioning, dealing specifically with property taxes. So I'm trying to get this understood. So an oil and gas corporation that's making money under Title 43.20 has now, in your opinion, a transferable tax credit and that credit could be purchased by a company who's also in the same field, and it could be used against their property tax liability. Is that basically?
Yeah, I believe as it's currently written, that would be applicable. Correct me if I'm wrong.
And then follow up.
Go ahead.
So I guess what, you know, that if we're doing oil and gas development on the North Slope, I guess this transferable credit then could go to a company, say, in Fairbanks or Anchorage, not affiliated with necessarily what's going on in the North Slope, and property taxes in that community could be dropped but not to zero for facilities and for facilities that have to do with specifically that case. That
person. Yeah, right now the municipalities, of course, would be the opt-in. So it wouldn't necessarily allow them, but it's actually an excellent point that we need to make sure that we clarified that. Can someone in Fairbanks drop it? When would it drop their tax liability in that location? So, well, I'll actually make sure that we look through that through the chair.
Thank you. Other questions for the sponsor? Representative Seaton, I see that look in your eye.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I'm still just trying to figure out the parameters. So normally, I mean, oftentimes what we've done on these is to try to look at a transferable tax credits to small companies so that they don't get, they have to transfer that to somebody else, and probably it's going to be at a cost. Yeah. Whether that was when we were talking about oil exploration tax credits, we were worrying about 70 or 80% of the amount would be bid by somebody to do that. And so since we're almost making it that the company that gets the tax credit cannot use it unless they're an oil company, then I'm trying to figure out if this is the mechanism that you want to use to stimulate in-state manufacturing when the manufacturer is told that you're not going to get the full value of the tax credit. You're going to have to transfer it to somebody, probably at a discount, and to gain any benefit out of it. And I don't know how they will know what that benefit's going to be until after it's done and they have the credit, and then it goes onto the market to be transferred. So that's my question. That's my problem. I'm trying to figure out the answer there.
Right. Appreciate that. And actually, what I'd probably request of the committee is actually to, through the chair, I would probably request that we have one of the guys from Vigor come up as they've worked with us on this and kind of how they perceive the application of this thing. Of course, they're the ones that we're trying to incentivize the people to utilize them, and we worked really hard with them on some. And that's why some of this has been, there's been a lot of back and forth with them and with the tax division to make sure that we've got it. I'd probably ask them to come up and probably answer that question. They'd probably be more appropriate for it.
Okay. I understand. I'm sorry, Representative Crowe, do you have Vigor online there?
They're in the back, behind me. There's several members from their organization.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Peggy Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think I'll be able to answer that a little bit, too, because if a company wants something made and they have to decide, okay, who's going to make it, if they get a discount if they have somebody in the state make it versus if they go outside and they don't get a discount, it just encourages them to have someone in state manufacture that for them.
Yeah.
So that's okay. That's where the benefit is the jobs that it creates here in Alaska. So it might not benefit the company that's making it in a direct way, but indirectly it will, because they will get maybe a job manufacturing something that they wouldn't have gotten otherwise.
Are there other questions for the sponsor? I see Representative Tarr and then Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to understand this issue related to the property taxes in question, I understood it to be written to only apply to oil and gas property taxes that were due to the state not to municipalities. And so I just wanted to try and have that clarification. And then after maybe those folks, we can have the individual, Mr. Fonder, take a question on the couple of questions on the fiscal note.
Through the chair. You're correct.
Okay.
That is exactly who it's for.
Okay.
One of the things that we do, we have, we try to write in there the option for the municipalities to have that ability as well. Of course, that would be not something I would mandate on them. But you're correct. It does apply specifically to the state with the option of municipalities being able to take that. That's the goal.
Okay. Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, so the large Alaskan oil company contracts with a manufacturer to produce something for some new project under up on the North Slope. They're limited in the current statute to no more than $10 million on these tax credits. To take in any one particular year, they can pass these. They can sort of hold these credits and utilize them in successive tax years out to I guess a limit of 5 years. If we make this thing transferable, do we have the effect of they can actually spend more than $10 million and get in excess of say they spend $20 million? They can only use 10 million of those credits in any given year, so what your bill would do would allow them to transfer that excess off to another company for that other company to be able to apply. Is that correct?
So you're indicating that if they, because we're not, it's specifically we have in here that they're not able to reduce their tax liability below zero. You're referring that if they had more than what their tax liability was, that we could transfer it to someone else?
No, if they had more than, they're limited to $10 million in any particular year.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Correct? So if they say they spend $15 million and they want to take $15 million worth of credits, they can only utilize $10 million of those credits.
So they transfer the other.
They transfer the other
$5 million to someone else to utilize. That's what you're indicating.
Perhaps we'll defer till a side discussion later on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Other questions from the committee for Representative Stephen?
One question. I'm just trying to find where in the U version it has it that these are optional for other communities, for other taxpayers.
For the record, Dirk Kraft, staff to Rep. Pruitt. Through the chair, Rep. Seaton, we haven't put that in there. It's something that we've discussed, but we haven't put the option in there yet.
Through the chair, this Rep. Pruitt. It's been a work in progress. So I appreciate the patience on that. This one, it's gone through several itinerations over the time that we've gotten to this point. But that's the intent, just so that you know. That was the intent. It's not in this particular version. Thank you.
Okay. See, no other questions for the sponsor or staff? Let me see if there are questions. Representative Tony, you had a question for the Department of Revenue?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. If we get Matt Fonder online, you have to listen carefully.
Thank you. Mr. Fonder, just looking at page 2 of the fiscal note here, in the revenues part, the department is unable to determine the amount of credits which may be claimed by taxpayers as the department currently has no information. Because this could be, you know, millions of dollars of tax credits per year, do you have any way of giving us some way to evaluate the fiscal impact or additional information while it wouldn't be exact, that would just give us more than that, which is just doesn't tell us much at all?
Through the chairman, Representative Tarr, or can you hear me okay?
Yes, can you give us your name for the record, Mr. Fonder?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Matt Fonder. Excuse me. And I am the director of the tax division for the Department of Revenue. And that's a great question, Representative Tarr. It's a difficult one to answer because the manufacturing credit, which we're talking about, which was implemented under Senate Bill 21, or which was adopted under Senate Bill 21, has yet to have a full year. So we really don't even have any good, solid information on the credit that was passed under SB 21, which is what this is based off of. So it is really difficult to put a number on this because we don't know what kind of activity is currently going on out there and what type of activity may occur if this were to pass. So it's a really difficult question.
Okay. Yep, thank you. Ms. Question okay. From...
Can I actually add to that? One of the things I think is important to indicate why this would be indeterminate is we're not doing this. We're currently not looking in state to manufacture some, especially when it comes to our maritime oil and gas development. We're not looking in state to do it. So it's going to be indeterminate because it's not currently something that we have out there. So you can't make an analysis off of something that doesn't currently exist. And I think that's probably plays into why this would be indeterminate. Right now, there would not be a tax liability to the state. There's not a credit that the state would be paying. There's nothing out there. But if we enact something and we allow someone to be able to look in state to be able to manufacture their offshore platforms or some of the other things that we could see off the coast if you go over to Nikiski, those items out there, when that stuff starts to be built up here, then we're talking about a potential impact to state revenues. And the ability, the lesser amount coming in, essentially, as we won't be paying out.
Yeah. Question from Representative Hawker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question pulls completely out of the details of the legislation and into, I think, certainly my mindset and my understanding of the provision in Senate Bill 21 that gave rise to the Qualified Oil and Gas Service Industry Expenditure Credit.
Yeah.
I remember that process. It came in kind of as one of those amended in things.
That's right.
A little late in the process and all that. I recall so I'm not picking on your bill. I'm just going back to what I recall about the process on 21, that I remember reading that and looking at it, and as it came through, truly analyzing it, going, okay, the way it's written into the corporate income tax section, who's qualified to take it. I kind of remember looking at that going, actually, I remember very clearly saying, you know, this is really going to be a very seldom used credit. And obviously, it is a seldom used credit, but we've now got people looking at it and saying, well, I want to use it.
Right.
You know, and I guess a big part of our Senate 21 conversation was about limiting the applicability of the front loaded credits that had really overweighted unbalanced our tax system to putting way too much credit value up front against a way too high tax rate at the back end of it. And I guess I'm really asking myself now, not from a technical point here, but I think your bill in some ways is actually changing what I saw as what I thought would be the intent and consequences of 2021. It's not so much a clarification bill as it's really a piece of legislation to substantially increase the applicability of this credit. And to that end, I'll be honest with you, I'm not so sure I'm really there. I understand, you know, people would be wanting to take advantage of it, but it seems to go contrary to the philosophy that was behind our development of Senate 21 in the instance of reining way back in these front-end credits and also balancing that against the change in out-year taxation and specifically who might be entitled to take it. You know, that said, every year is a separate policy call, and I appreciate that and appreciate the dialogue being in front of us. I'm just not quite sure where I get to with it.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, appreciate that. I mean, we are not necessarily off in our agreement on that. Reason I felt the need to go ahead and bring this forward and address it is because while it is out there and it does exist, that provision is out there. I saw an area of the state when I was down in Southeast that did not necessarily get the chance to participate in what I see is a benefit to most of Alaska in the development, the exploration of oil and gas resources in our state. And so while I would agree with you, and we should not burden ourselves in the capacity that we had under ACES, I felt that this was one way to use something that is out there that some people are potentially going to be able to utilize, even if it's very few, to allow Southeast Alaska to participate in oil and gas development in Alaska, as well as utilize one of our assets, the facility that ADA owns, on a larger scale.
If I might follow that up.
Oh, Representative Hawker.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, absolutely agree. And to that end, and I'll acknowledge I'm working a little on the fly here.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't quite processed this through my head completely. This gets back to why I kind of liked the language in the, was it the A version of the bill?
Mm-hmm.
The first version that allowed that transfer to an initial purchaser who would be a, presumably, a large player, or at least a participant on the North Slope with the possibility or probability that they have a corporate income tax liability. And again, that first concept, I've got to admit, I was getting pretty comfortable with that. And if I might continue briefly.
Certainly.
Because once we start invading, taking a tax that is otherwise applicable to corporate income tax and now allowing it transfer on a transferable tax certificate to allowing it apply against property taxes, we open up a whole new can of worms because of the interplay between the way state and local property taxes work. And it, you know, creates some complexities that I haven't sorted out in my head yet, but we might want to think, I would only offer from my own head, that we might want to think about what we're really trying to do with this overall and make sure we land where we, and we really target who we want to benefit, make sure they get the benefit we want in the most efficient and effective way that doesn't create another one of those. And by that, as a guy spent his life as a CPA, I can't tell you how many times I dealt with screwed up laws that were impossible to interpret, especially when it came to excise taxes in the state. And there was no indictment of yourself. That was just amusing on past history with state excise taxes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hawker through the chair, appreciate that. Duly noted, and I appreciate that.
You can thank you. I got Representative Kawasaki, then Seaton, then Johnson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being here. I guess I share some of the concerns with property taxes and corporate income taxes and the transferability, dealing with local taxation issues. But I guess you'll get more answers to us on that.
Yeah.
My questions have to do with the modifications and specifically what constitutes a modification. I know this committee's had various bills dealing with credits for modification of under the what was it? It was recently the Fisherman's Fund. It was the Edgman bill dealing with manufacturing for boats and things like that. Can you kind of explain and go over modifications? And maybe this is a question that's got to be punted up to
Representative Kawasaki through the chair. I would probably pose that question to our tax people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then we got Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm trying to follow the conversation here that this isn't applicable now because they're building a pipeline from the west side of Cook Inlet over to the Tesoro refinery. How many millions of dollars that'll be for that pipeline? My reading of this, the oil service industry is going to be building that pipeline, so 10% of the total cost is going to be a tax credit that the state is going to participate in building 10% of that pipeline. And can you correct me in there? Because I don't want to get it wrong.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, and you probably noticed by my nodding head that I probably disagree. No, I mean, this is not, the intent is not any, just work that is done. It's really the asset that is either manufactured or modified at the facility. So, for instance, a pipeline across Cook Inlet, it's not going to be manufactured or modified at the facilities, whether it's Ketchikan or whether it's Seward. Now, a boat that is, you know, digging up the whatever's needed to lay the pipe down, that potentially could be manufactured or modified at the facility. And that would be an asset that would apply, that this would apply. Does that help clarify?
So, Seaton?
I've got to go back and review the constraints on SB 21 service industry expenditure credit, because, you know, for building a facility, whether it's, you know, for doing a gas treatment plant on the North Slope, you know, I'm not sure whether we are going to be the service industry that builds that qualifies or not. So,
just a point of clarification.
I don't know.
Representative Hawker.
A point of clarification, we're discussing only tangible personal property.
Thank you very much.
Good deal. With that, Representative Johnson is up next.
Thank you, I think. I'm trying to recall the SB 21 conversations we had, largely in this committee. And part of this manufacturing was to apply against corporate income tax. And part of the discussion at the time was there would be a rethinking of companies. Instead of being sole proprietors, maybe they would look at this as an opportunity to become corporations and pay corporate income tax. And I understand I'd love to be able to tax ADA, but that's probably not going to happen. So, you know, I'm a little concerned about taking it beyond that, because kind of the purpose of that was to move more people into the tax rolls. That's one of the reasons that we discussed in this committee that we're going to do it. So that concern. The other concern is on what Representative Hawker said about it applying directly to the purchaser, and I'm wondering if we run afoul of the interstate commerce because we're offering a discount beyond a normal discount for an in-state purchase, very much like we ran with the, you know, there's a limit, and we dealt with it in fishing license, out-of-state, in-state. And there's a number that the court has kind of set that we can do a certain amount but not over. So I'm wondering where this falls in that particular, and maybe Ledger Legal can address that better than I certainly.
To that point,
a question that I have.
To that point, maybe Representative Peggy Wilson has an answer.
I believe that the intent was, and I don't see in the bill where it does say that they have the option. That's why if the communities have the option to go in or out, then that gets around that part. But I don't see that in the bill itself at this point in time, this new version, and we'd have to make sure that that was in there.
And my, Mr. Chairman, my question to kind of follow up on that, what if Bremerton wanted to do it? I mean, it's a community. Maybe they offered the discount. I mean, where do we get into that interstate? At what level? Is it 10%? Is it 15%? Can we offer 50%? There's a number that we can do for local hire and for local manufacturer. We can do that, but there's a number that we can't go above. And I'd be curious to see where that would fall as it relates to this kind of project. So,
yeah, Mr. Chair, and I would probably pose that second one to maybe Ledge Legal or someone that probably could appropriately answer that. The first one, though, I do want to make sure that I want to address the first piece, which was the discussion related to the corporate income tax and getting people to maybe potentially move into paying income tax, which is valid, and I actually agree with the notion of making sure that we have people that are paying, which is hence the reason why the property tax discussion still had individuals that are paying a tax. And so it was just another way of allowing for the LLCs that aren't going to have, so I don't, you know, Vigor and, of course, ADA, like you said, we're not going to have those corporate taxes. And I don't perceive, even with, if we were to apply this to corporate tax, that they would have a benefit in doing it. So we're not going to see them moving there. And so how do we facilitate something where
they are paying tax, and we're not going below zero. And that's where kind of the idea came from. Again, I'll give credit, and he may shoot me later if this blows up, but, you know, to Mike Pulaski for highlighting that there might be this opportunity in the property tax piece.
Okay. I know we've got some more questions, some stuff to be worked out in our minds, but we do have with us some folks who want to testify in public on this, so it might be a good point to open up public testimony and call either Mr. Kiga or Mr. Ward from Bigger to the stand to give us their public testimony on this. Thank you, Representative Pruitt. Sure. Just give us your name and your title for your record.
Yes. Chairs Sadler and Fagy, members of the House Resources Committee. My name is Fred Kiga, Senior Vice President of Vigor Industrial. We are the parent of Vigor Alaska. Here today to support House Bill 334, I want to thank Representative Pruitt as well as his staff, as well as the Department of Revenue with respect to the development of this concept. And I say concept because, as Representative Pruitt stated, it is a work in progress. But conceptually, we were looking at SB 21 last year and looking for ways to truly enhance in-state manufacturing of tangible personal property for the oil and gas development field, as well as production field, and found in through a series of 6 to 8 months of talking with DOR, specifically Deputy Commissioner Mike Pulaski, we looked at various avenues in which to frame a credit that is designed to enhance employment for Alaskans, a credit that is designed to enhance economic development for the state of Alaska ultimately. And what we came down on was the use of a property tax credit, chapter 4356, to develop that concept. You know, when we look at the production income tax credit and whether or not companies actually have tax nexus for purposes of using that credit at times, it's somewhat squishy. In the case of the property tax, if you're within the jurisdiction of the state of Alaska, you are, and you have tangible property there, you are generally subject to the state property tax. And when a out-of-state oil and gas company looks at, geez, is this capital asset going to meet our return requirements? They can now look at the provisions of 4356 and say, geez, that's a credit against my expenses going forward. And that helps for me to clearly evaluate up front the economic cost of whether to invest and as well whether to use an in-state manufacturer to create that asset. And so from the 10,000-foot level, that's what we are trying to do. That's what we came up with the Department of Revenue, and that's where we're trying to head with respect to House Bill 334. But that's, in a nutshell, what we are attempting to do.
Thank you, Mr. Kiga. Mr. Ward.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, committee members. My name is Doug Ward. I'm the Director of Shipyard Development for Vigor Alaska now, and have been associated with the Ketchikan Shipyard for 20 years now. And I have to say that it was a great use of that 20 years.
It's probably one closer than it does in the
closer.
Yep.
It's been just a tremendous project down there to see some of the young people we have working in that yard today, and just the pride and the joy that they have building ships in Alaska. It's really a rewarding project. I want to talk a little bit about the challenges that we have in Alaska as a shipbuilder and ship repair and as a marine industrial provider of services. Because of the partnership that exists between AIDA and the communities of Ketchikan and industry. Alaska now has probably one of the most modern shipbuilding factories in North America. Certainly, that's true for a yard the size that we have in Ketchikan. Our workforce, we not only focus on best practice for facility design and infrastructure, but we also have a very heavy focus on how we build our human infrastructure. So along with our development plan for the yard, we have a workforce development plan that is showing results. We have, in 2013, 161 workers, 13% are women. It's 8 years younger than the national average for a shipyard workforce. It's productive as all get out, and they do some wonderful work. The project itself was an economic development project through ADA initially. It actually was started by DOT to be a ferry maintenance facility. Then when ADA took it over, we brought shipbuilding into the mix along with repair. And that shipbuilding component of the yard provides a stable workforce all year round and a stable economic base for the more seasonal repair sides of things. So shipbuilding we've been very successful at. We've built two airport ferries for the Ketchikan Airport. We've done, had this been a U.S. project, might have been qualified for a tax credit, but we built a marine fueling station that went down to Vancouver for the Olympics. We built the Susitna, which was the world's first ice-strengthened twin-hulled vessel destined for service in Cook Inlet. But in my opinion, we'll probably end up in a North Slope serving oil and gas at some point because of its ice-strengthened capability. And we also just completed a longliner for the Bering Sea. So we do have a shipbuilding history. We have experience at it now. And as we look forward and what House Bill 334 could do, would be to accelerate the return on investment that the state has in that shipyard. Already we're beginning to see businesses move into Ketchikan. In the last 2 months, we've had two naval architecture firms open offices in Ketchikan. And there's two international marine electronics firms that are looking at opening shops in Ketchikan. It's that vendor base that we lack in the state of Alaska compared to other regions like the Gulf of Mexico, or even Puget Sound for that matter. So we believe that House Bill 334 will move us into the oil and gas industry sooner. We haven't really seen much of the activity in Southeast, and we'll also help encourage those people that are, in fact, there is a layer of customers out there that are below the oil and gas majors. They're the we're going to be the marine operators that are buying ships, operating vessels, and that's where we see 334 being of value to those kinds of customers. Cook Inlet is, as you all know, beginning to take off. We're looking at that very hard. You probably heard that we're looking at the Seward Shipyard. All of this, of course, is to look at oil and gas. As we look at the future, LNG in particular, small LNG projects would be a very, very useful, that would be a market that 334 could work in very well. And what I mean by that is the distribution of the small LNG projects with marine transport as the pipeline that we move things around the state. I know this winter, and I think a lot of people in Southeast are burning diesel right now to generate electrical power with. And if we could switch those diesel generating plants over to LNG and reduce that cost by 20-30%, that would be a huge advantage to stimulate more manufacturing in Southeast Alaska. So that's how I see 334 looking forward. These are expensive assets that we build. They take years to put together. The how you finance these projects are important, and I think 334 will be a very useful ship finance tool for the state of Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee for the Representative Vigor? Representative Tarr, Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So it sounds like, Mr. Ward, what you're saying is right now you wouldn't say that projects that would qualify for this credit are part of the portfolio of things that, you know, have been under construction as projects you've had so far, but you think this is one way that we might see that type of activity?
Absolutely. through the chair, if I may. Currently, the oil and gas industry defaults to the Gulf of Mexico. There's nearly 60 years of activity around oil and gas down there. You look at Port Fourchon, the purpose-built deepwater port, all of the vendors through oil and gas. It's a very mature industry down there, and as a result, the shipyards are very competitive. So as we look at trying to replicate this marine industrial activity in the state of Alaska, it takes one. We have great huge distances with not a lot of people. We don't have a vendor base. Our environmental regulations are much more severe than they are in the Gulf of Mexico. Our labor rates are much higher. And we pay a living wage, good wages to our workers. In fact, 48% more than the average annual earnings in Southeast Alaska is where our wages are there. So as we look ahead at trying to compete with other regions around the nation, these types of tax credits and things are going to be, I think, really help people make a decision to use Alaska manufacturers.
I might add, through the chair, that, of course, it has to meet the definition of modification or manufacturing as Department of Revenue has defined such terms.
That was Mr. Keegan.
And just
question, follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, as we've kind of discussed this before in the context of Senate Bill 21 and other bills, that there are some physical limitations to our locations that it's been described before might exclude us from some of those projects, but are you seeing then there's a certain set that would be, the shipyard in Ketchikan would be the appropriate size to build? It's been suggested sort of some of the large size modules and things. We're not building those in Alaska. We're just not going to get there facility-wise. And so is there something more to that?
Well, that's a very good point, Representative. Thank you for bringing it up to the chair. I think initially, as we move into oil and gas and these industrial markets, all of us that have manufacturing capacity in the state need to be very careful about what we go after. We are certainly limited. In our case, our yard is built around a 250-foot vessel. All of the facilities and the workforce are built around that. Now we can go up as large as a 500-foot vessel if we want to, but the most optimal size vessel that we're set up for is 250 feet. So in terms of services that you have available in your community or in any community, the what your facility is designed to build are all key considerations. And as I look forward, there's going to be so much opportunity that there'll be lots of work left over that we don't want to compete for, at least in the next 10 or 20 years. Now, as we move forward and gain industrial capacity and the vendor base and the scale, which we could probably 10 to 20 years from now, begin looking at some of those larger projects in the state.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess in your business plan, if this bill is to eventually become law, what kind of things do you envision manufacturing, and how do they fit under the definition of qualified oil and gas service industry expenditures?
Yes, thank you for the question, through the chair. That's a really good question. Later this month, I think March 21st, representatives of Exxon are going to be coming down to Ketchikan to look at the yard, and they have some projects for Port Thompson that are manufacturing what they call a standard fuel tank. They're double-walled tanks of around 1,000 gallons or something, but you need a lot of those. So that's one opportunity that we would look at more of on a storage side. On the marine transportation side, there are small LNG carriers that are small cryogenic ships that are being developed in Norway to distribute gas to small communities. Or there are a series of barges with cryogenic containers either in the hull or on the hull that can be dropped off at coastal communities on roughly, I think, about a monthly basis. So we'd be looking at articulated tug and barge setups for distribution all around the state, potentially some of the work around the liquefaction plants or the re-liquefaction plants, some of that the heavy manufacturing we could accommodate down there, and then the marine transportation component of distributing gas around the state.
Through the chair, I might add that to the extent that oil and gas exploration develops on the Chukchi and Beaufort seas, there's the likelihood of some of the supply vessels that accompany the drill rigs, rather than coming all the way down to the Gulf or the lower 48, many of them may stop and get serviced in the Ketchikan and or, if that happens, the Seward Yard, and assuming that it meets the definition of modifications or manufacturing under the existing statute, that would qualify for the credit as well.
Okay. Actually, a question for Mr. Ward. As you described the small LNG carriers, which about what size capacity are you talking?
You know, I was looking for that just at lunch. I knew someone was going to ask me. And these energy units are that thing. But in terms of size of vessel, and there's 30,000 or 50,000. I can't remember if that was million cubic feet or barrels of oil equivalent. I'm not really comfortable with all these new units yet. But in terms of the ship size, they range from 250 to maybe 600-foot LNG carriers. So they're relatively small. They're within our range to build and maintain here.
Okay, good deal. Good deal. Other questions for the gentleman from Vigor? Great. Seeing none, I do have another question for a representative of the Department of Revenue. I think we are fortunate to have the Deputy Commissioner here, so
thank you.
Mike, if you come up. Thank you very much, Sheldon. And Mike, if you'd introduce yourself for the record, and Representative Hawk has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Mike Pulowski, Deputy Commissioner of Revenue.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I figured we may as well start at the top.
Sure.
But you've got lots of lifelines. and actually, Mr. Chairman, I really appreciate that your folks provided us a copy of 4320.049, which passed SB 21 last year, that unfortunately is, of course, not yet in our code book. So, Mr. Pulowski, did you have a copy of 4320.049 in front of you?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hawker, through the chair, I borrowed one from the ABLE staff to the majority leader. So I do have one.
Thank you. Thank you. Just wanted to make sure we were on the same sheet of music.
Yep.
And I really always love having a dialogue with you. Two techno nits here, but I think it's something we all need to think about as we develop this bill into something that works. First is a bit more general, then we've got one very specific point. The general point is, and it's something, again, in the context that this whole thing came in as an amendment last year and was not vetted particularly well. But as it was written, I remember I looked at it and said, you know, I don't think there's going to be much use for this the way it's exactly drafted. So I wasn't too worried about it. But now that we're looking at making it more applicable and really granting a lot of latitude with it, I think we've got to consider the whole thing basically gets premised around you can get a starting in the first paragraph, you can apply a credit against the tax due under this chapter, which was, of course, the corporate income tax chapter, mm-hmm. for a qualified oil and gas service industry expenditure incurred in this state. Then we go to definitions, of course. Mm-hmm. Qualified oil and gas service industry expenditure means an expenditure directly attributable to an in-state manufacturer or an in-state modification of tangible personal property. Not too hard to understand, but I am wondering about the layering of this credit. Now, as I think this through, I'm a guy drilling, you know, doing exploration on the North Slope or anywhere. I spend money with a vendor that is directly attributable to their manufacturing for me something. Likewise, that vendor's out there spending a whole lot of money with other vendors who are spending money with other vendors who are spending money with other vendors, I'm not so sure that we're totally clear that there is only one. I believe the intent is one credit with one piece of tangible personal property, but I just, with the Department of, and I'm not asking for a definitive answer, maybe a bit of a rhetorical question, but we need, I think we need to be sure we have A on the record that it is intended to be one credit, one piece of tangible personal property, but we may, in my own conclusion is we may need somehow to clarify that.
Representative Hawker, through the chair, thanks for the opportunity for a brief dialogue around the underlying statute, because we've seen other legislation discussed in the building that, that piggybacks off the statute as it was passed last year. Two comments. One is the nexus to the definition of tangible personal property used in the exploration for development of or production of oil and gas was written specifically because it's a nexus to the property tax statute. AS 4356 levies property taxes, oil and gas property tax at a statewide level, on tangible personal property used. So it was the manufacture of something that was going to create a tax base in the state to begin with. Second, if you look at the language, and if members have it in front of them, 4320049, I'd turn you to C. And C was included in the language because where it limits is it says to a taxpayer, if you are going to use an expenditure to claim this credit, you may not use that expenditure for a deduction against the tax levied under this chapter or a credit or deduction under another provision. So
that was my second question.
In your example of an explorer, an actual exploration company, with the loss carry forward that you remember this committee retained in Senate Bill 21 for the benefit of new entrants, with the exploration credits that are on the books, at least in Middle Earth for a little while, the use of that expenditure for a producer or explorer is more valuable as a deduction or a qualifying expenditure for one of the other credits under this chapter. That was the limiting utility in the way the underlying statute was drafted, is this narrowly applies to a group that really is a corporate income taxpayer who might be the service company who is then working with the actual producer or explorer themselves. So very open to keep working with the committee and members on sideboards around that language, but underlying it in the development of the credit, that was the limiting factor, is trying to recognize that the expenditure is actually more valuable in other places in statute.
Sorry, okay. Chair, if I might continue.
For a different question.
And I absolutely appreciate the grounding there on where the relative value of an individual expenditure falls, but still, am I not particularly wrong, is that someone claiming this particular credit, it's only once. I don't get to claim it, and the person I'm having do the work for me gets to claim it. But somewhere we're going to have to fix who actually gets that credit.
Representative Hawker, the chair, that's correct. That's absolutely the intent.
So then, Mr. Chair, if I might, I'd like to go back up to C, and just another, and this one just was identified, and I hadn't even really thought about this myself, but looking at C and parsing our way through it, item C, and if I might read, sir.
Go ahead.
An expenditure that is the basis of the credit under this section, of course, and this section is 4320, which is the corporate income tax. An expenditure that is the basis of the credit under this section may not be the basis for, and as you said, a deduction against the tax levy. So basically, you can't take a credit and a deduction at the same time. But number two, let's think about this for a second. And just forgetting item one and go back and read it again. An expenditure that is the basis of a credit under this section may not be the basis for a credit or deduction under another provision of this title. And that would make me wonder if we would need to create a specific exemption to that in order to allow the expenditure that's a basis for a credit or deduction under this title to be applied over to the 056 section rather than the 4320 section.
Mm-hmm.
not trying to put you on the spot, but I frankly, I just it, that one has caught my attention, and I think it's, again, we may have embedded in here a prohibition against what the bill is doing.
Representative Hawker, through the chair, thank you for the challenge. it, as you said, was crafted specifically narrowly last year. The decision to broaden the statute and the applicability is one that we will carefully think through and support technically.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Again, this one I will not claim credit for. I had somebody had that one pointed out to me, but I, again, would identify it as the type of thing where I have seen in my own career where we have legislators before we were here wrote statutes that were absolutely, totally, and completely incalculable and absolutely impossible to determine when some poor accountant really had to sit down and do it.
Gotcha.
No.
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 Thank you,
Representative Hunter. Should not be allowed to write tax law, Mr. Chair.
And just letting the committee members know, we do have another bill and might have an external testifier in the next bill, so I want to limit questions as much as we can on this one. So, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just following up on those two lines, the relative value, if an oil company is having somebody build something for them and by this 10% tax credit cannot use that as a deduction or a credit for anything else, it's going to be of absolutely no value. So, you know, this service, and I would really like to see where this could be applied, where anybody would use it, because if I was somebody in the oil industry, I sure wouldn't be giving away 25% tax credit for manufacturing something for on my field for somebody for a 10% tax credit. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. Good deal. Well, at this point, if there's more questions, if there's not more questions for Department of Revenue, Representative Tarr.
Just one quick comment. Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. Just in the original version of the bill, there was language that said, you know, that it could only be transferred to the initial purchaser of the tangible personal property. That was the basis for the credit. But in the U version, that language is not in there. And as we consider this, it just would think that we might want to include that language as being more clear to what Representative Hawker was speaking to. Thank you.
Okay. I think with that, we are going to hold public testimony open on this bill and hold this bill until another future date. There's some more questions, and it's an interesting discussion. So with that, thank you to Fish, and thank you, Representative Pruitt and Dirk, for bringing this forward. So we will hold public testimony open and turn next to the next item on the agenda, which is House Joint Resolution 30. And as I said, we do have a certain U.S. senator who may be calling in to testify as her schedule allows. So at that point, we will make accommodations for that. But in the meantime, Representative Heron, please introduce yourself for the record and give us a presentation on your initial discussion on H.J.R. 30.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and all members of the committee. House Joint Resolution 30. To some, because most of the people that voted on the Eisenbeck land swap were here, and they understand the issue. But the resolution actually is a dissection of the no action decision by now Secretary Sally Jewell. And it's basically, it is a flawed EIS that they did. They did not follow the law. And what it does is it points that out, and we're seeking to have the legislature endorse this resolution and send it back to Washington, D.C. Of course, what we're talking about is the ominous Public Land Management Act of 2009. And, of course, the legislature unanimously endorsed it. And then the act required there to be an EIS done. And, of course, it was worked on for 4 years. And as you know, Salazar, Secretary Salazar, and then Jewell reaffirmed that they wanted to take no action, essentially blocking the land swap and more importantly, the public safety corridor from King Cove to Cole Bay. But just stepping back a minute here, is that federal case law and congressional actions have reinforced the principle that trust responsibilities to Alaska Natives applies to all federal officials, all federal decisions, and all federal activities. Fish and Wildlife has conveniently felt they were exempt from this, and of course they're not. So, but actually DOT, excuse me, Department of Interior likes the situation that the federal government is in, is that the Bureau of Indian Affairs had the trust responsibility for Alaska Natives. Mm-hmm. And by custom, the Assistant Secretary of Interior Indian Affairs was, by custom, was an American Indian or Alaska Native. But OMB started reducing their funding, and then a presidential administration basically moved it into the White House Domestic Policy Council. And now it's conveniently housed, in most part, by the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. So the role of trust responsibility has gotten farther and farther away from the Department of Interior. And so the courts, the U.S. courts, have warned the federal officials that they are bound by every moral and equitable consideration to discharge this trust responsibility in good faith and fairness. And so, I mean, obviously, everyone can read the resolution, but there's so much background about what has happened and how, again, Fish and Wildlife feels that they're exempt, that they do not, they don't have a responsibility to public safety and humans. And of course, Congress has explicitly associated trust responsibility with six federal departments: education, energy, health and social service, housing and urban development, and labor, and the Department of the Interior. Just a couple more comments about the background of this decision. And it is that, just one more note here. Yes, if you turn to page 2, line 4, of course, we endorsed it. We loved it. We want this trade to happen. But if you move down to line 29 on page 2, Fish and Wildlife Service said publicly, after Secretary Sally Jewell called up Senator Lisa Murkowski on December 23rd on 2013 and said no action, we're not going to do anything. This FLAC said safety considerations are important, but they were not the factor in this decision, at least not a factor we analyzed, since we only analyzed the environmental impacts, which we called upon to do since we are not a public safety organization. Well, everybody in this room has seen a Fish and Wildlife employee pack a weapon. There's been recent actions by the Fish and Wildlife. They do actions that do protect public safety. But for on them to sit back and say, oh, we don't have to do that because we didn't feel like we had to. So fast forward to 2013, and I was in King Cove when the Assistant Secretary Washburn visited communities, and I was there with Senator Lisa Murkowski when the Secretary Jewell visited that communities. And what they've left out, chose to, is they have not produced a decision that's required of them, and it's called the public interest finding. And in this interest of finding, it's to for the federal government to state why there is no need to have a interest finding specifically related to medical evacuations of Alaska Natives, all members of that community, out of a dangerous situation. Now, what the resolution says is that the impact statement did not include biological and technical information gathered. They purposely ignored that stuff, those provisions. And so the Secretary, page 4, line 15, she did not provide the reports that are required. She just said two remarkable things in the same community, two different times at Minnie, excuse me. She listened to all the students at the gymnasium, K through 12. She listened to a lot of stories, a lot of passionate stories. She said, and I quote, "I've listened to your concerns, now I must listen to the animals." And then she walked across the street and essentially did the same thing at the community meeting. Mr. Chairman, committee members, Fish and Wildlife thinks it's exempt from a trust responsibility to Alaska Natives. And that is essentially this is about how they purposely and willingly did not follow the act. They do not follow congressional case law. And then, of course, when I was in Washington, D.C. last week and having a conversation with our senator, Senator Murkowski asked if she could testify on this legislation. This is important to her because it is an example of how callous the Department of Interior has become to its responsibility and trust responsibility to Alaska. And finally, Mr. Chairman, in your packet of information I gave, there's one that has three bird hunters, and on the backside there is a description of the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. And of course, in their no action decision, they specifically called upon one of the reasons is of the black brant in the eelgrass. But this is you can go to the website right now and you can pull this up, and it says hardy waterfowlers can hunt in eelgrass to pursue and achieve their daily bag limit of black brant, then go upland and hunt for ptarmigan. What? This trust responsibility, Mr. Chairman, is not a limitation on Alaska Natives' freedoms and rights. It is a limit on the federal government over Alaska Natives and Alaskans, and specifically the entire Department of Interior's limit over us. The most recent Eisenbeck decision has utterly ignored the responsibilities that the federal government is required to maintain. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Herron. Appreciate that. The question is lined up. Representative Hawker has a question.
More of a comment, if I might, Mr. Chair. I'd like to thank the sponsor for bringing this bill forward. This whole issue has brought me personally as a state legislator to a slow burn. And I mean, that burn has gone beyond smoking. I mean, it ought to be a raging fire with every single person in the state legislature and every person in the state of Alaska. And this foolishness from the feds has got to end. It is completely and totally irresponsible for them to stand in the way of what truly is a public safety measure. And I would assure the sponsor that if I had any way to do it, I personally would get a bulldozer out there and start building the road and let them come stop us. I think, it has reached that point in dealing with the feds on this issue that it's time to stop sending these strongly worded letters of support for something they are obviously not going to do. This time we took these matters into our own hands and just did it. But that said, I'll be happy to support your resolution. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hawker. Mr. Chairman, I had the wonderful opportunity to visit with our congressional delegation. All three of our members of our delegation, those people are fired up. They're strident in the way that we're being treated. And so, Mr. Chairman, it is, again, when I visited with our senior senator, I hope she regales you today with some personal interactions that she's had with the secretary. It shouldn't be, but it's become personal.
Next, Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Bob, for being here. So when we do road projects, we always have, project alternatives. Maybe you don't do a lot of roads in your area, but, we always have project alternatives, and it goes through the public process. The public gets to weigh in, and they have alternative 1, 2, or 3. In a no-action alternative, what exactly is the next step from the state's perspective or federal government?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kawasaki, for 4 years they did work, the coordinated agencies, Fish and Wildlife, and every agency related to this issue, mm-hmm. worked with the communities, worked with the tribes, et cetera, and that they came up that there was no alternative other than this road. But the EIS ignored that. Even all the federal and state and local agencies, their decision was complete. It's just that, I mean, this is an editorial, but you know, I believe this was a pre-engineered decision to say no action, and it was above Sally Jewell's pay grade. But yes, there is they did study it, and there's other people that are going to testify that it can articulate it even more so.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, and Mr. Harebaugh, thank you for doing this. And I think every time we get a chance, we need to put on the record what exactly we were going prepared to give up as a state and the local communities there. Can you just tell what was the acreage swap, just so that everyone can have it on record and we can talk about it on a regular basis? What were they getting versus what we were getting?
They were receiving, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I'll just round it up, round it to the closest large number, 60,000 acres, and in return, the state, the local region would get 206 acres.
Speaks for itself, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
I can't do the math, but that's a heck of a ratio.
It's a good ratio. I take that. I do that trade-off.
But Mr. Chairman, just one final comment. It really is incredulous, is that, you know, even though they're required to consider the human factor and the public safety factor, that was irrelevant to the Fish and Wildlife and the Department of Interior.
Mm-hmm. Representative Herring, pardon me. Are there other examples of where the federal government has agreed to be bound by that trust responsibility you mentioned?
In my research, there's maybe not specifically to that's similar to this, but yes, case law is all throughout history when it comes to their responsibility under Title 16 of our Constitution and in our federal laws. But of course, you know of instances are like this. And it's just an indifference that is prevalent. They're long far away. They feel that Congress has taken over the trust responsibilities of Alaska Natives and American Indians, and so they're somehow, they're not, that's not what they do. And so I think that case law has proved it over and over and over again. But even to issues unrelated to this specific one, of course, Alaska history proves it. But it really is, there's much broader base of this fear of this 8 Mile Road public safety corridor. The Department of Interior is afraid that if they agree to this, then they'll have to put a public safety corridor in every wilderness and every refuge. And that's what they're fighting.
So the point is, we can't have people being safe in refuges, right? Anyway. Representative Hawker, question.
Now, if I've got my decimal point right, Mr. Chair, the land we are giving in exchange for what we are getting is 34 ten-thousandths of what we're giving away.
Ask an accountant. He's got an answer. Any other questions for the sponsor? Representative Hawker, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question that Representative Kawasaki asked, in that evaluation, they would have been looking at other transportation alternatives. But just for my understanding of the issue, have we looked at other public safety improvements that might, you know, be something that would help address some of the immediate health care needs, for example? Are there other things that we might want to be thinking about that may not have come up with this particular proposal?
Well, it's the environment, Mr. Chairman, Representative Tarr, is that where the map that you have in your packet, where the airport is 100 days a year, it's 00. Of course, we're King Cove is. It's an important port for the fishing industry, and it's a safe harbor. But the minute you get out a little bit, I mean, you're talking about some real rock and roll. And so it really becomes an issue of safe medical evacuation. I mean, people have died, 18 documented. That includes the Coast Guard. Of course, in the packet, there is my press release about how King Cove's heart was broken, is that that day, it was 70 miles an hour. You couldn't go by boat. You couldn't get out on the airport. And the Coast Guard did come in. They didn't want to. There was no medical assistance, just the four crew members, and they barely got the woman out. She survived. That was having heart issues. It's really the environment. You have a community of about 1,000 people that live 25 miles away from the third largest runway in Alaska. It is actually, if they were still flying, it was the second alternative to the space shuttle. That's how big the airport is. Mm-hmm. And you can get a life med in there almost any time into that airport. So it's about defined at every alternative besides the road was completely vetted by the coordinated agencies. Mm-hmm. And they tried they did try the hovercraft, but it's expensive, not reliable, and the conditions in that region are challenging, to say the least.
Mm-hmm. Okay. With that, Representative Heron, thank you for that. I'm going to open public testimony now, and I believe we're going to go to one testifier off-net at this point. So if can you hear us online there, Senator?
I can. Can you hear me?
Thank you. Hey, Senator Murkowski, if you'd give us your name on the record and give us your testimony on the resolution so able introduced by Representative Heron already.
Thank you. My name is Lisa Murkowski, United States Senator for Alaska.
Great, go ahead.
I am pleased to be able to spend a few moments with the committee to support House Joint Resolution 30 that's been introduced by Representative Heron. I have submitted written testimony that I understand that you, Chairman Feige, and Chairman Sadler should have, but if I can just take a couple moments and add to that written testimony a supplement to the record here. This is an issue that I think we as Alaskans are well versed in the facts. I do believe that the resolution lays out very thoroughly the history of long fight that the 950 residents of King Cove have been engaged in over the years, actually over decades, to gain access to a safety corridor so that they can access the second longest runway in our state, as Representative Heron has mentioned, for purposes of really life safety. One thing that I think is important to reinforce, the Secretary's decision on the 23rd of December, where she rejected the road alternative, this was a rejection of not only a legislative act that had been, again, worked with all of the respective agencies, legislation passed through the United States Senate, concurred with by the House of Representatives, signed into law by the President of the United States. The one thing remaining was for best interest determination coming from the Secretary of the Interior. But effectively what this Secretary has done is to really ignore the will of Congress, the very specific will of Congress, with this land exchange that would allow for this safety corridor for the people of King Cove. When I explained to folks back here in Washington, D.C., that this is a 300-to-1 exchange, where the native peoples there in King Cove are willing to give up lands that they were received as part of their native land settlements, that the state has agreed that the exchange would allow for new wilderness areas in the state where we have held firm against any additional wilderness. And that still, this was not good enough for the Secretary of the Interior, a 300-to-1 exchange. It defies, really, belief. It defies logic. I have called it a stunning injustice to the people of King Cove, and really, even beyond that, an injustice to the people of Alaska. We hear far too often the frightening circumstances within which people in King Cove, when medical issues threaten them and they have to leave their community to gain medical assistance in Anchorage, the dangerous, life-threatening situation that folks are placed in. And we saw that play out just on Valentine's Day with a medical evacuation of a woman who is in very serious condition. If not for the heroics of the Coast Guard, who knows what might have happened there. But in addition to a situation where the residents of King Cove are not able to gain safety, think about the dangerous situation that we put the men and women of the Coast Guard in, the pilots and crews that have to, and willingly attempt to make these rescues at considerable risk to themselves, and incidentally not without considerable financial expense to the taxpayers when they go in. When the simple answer is this 10-mile, one-lane, gravel, non-commercial use road. Secretary Jewell, as has been mentioned in your resolution, indicated that she would work to help the people of King Cove when she made the decision to reject the road, but there has been no idea, no proposal transmitted thus far. Not one employee that I can find at Interior has done anything to improve the situation. And each day that passes, the people of King Cove are further put at risk because of a decision that our own federal government has made. So it is important. I so appreciate that as a committee you have advanced a resolution, and a resolution that is strong and clear and lays forth the facts on the ground, and again, the reason why it's imperative that all of us throughout the state work to address this wrong that has been brought about by Secretary Jewell's decision. I think this resolution will help affirm that as Alaskans we are united in opposition to the Secretary's decision, and that we're united in our desire to protect the health and safety of those who live in King Cove. With that, Mr. Chairman, I will conclude my oral comments. Again, I have submitted a written statement for the record. I'm happy to take any questions, but I thank you for the opportunity to call in.
Thank you, Senator, for calling in. I appreciate you taking time out of your long day, late hours. We will receive your written testimony with pleasure. It's not yet in the packets, but will be distributed after this meeting. I got a question from Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator, for being online. It was really good to see you this weekend. And as for some of us on this panel, we took the wrong trek back home yesterday or the day before, and all of us can't understand how you can possibly do it going back and forth, but we certainly do appreciate what you do for Alaska down there. I just wanted to ask a question because the Senator, or I'm sorry, Secretary Jewell has made overtures that she'd like to speak with the delegation on this. This is it's a well-written six-page, I mean, this is probably one of the larger resolutions I've read, and I just made an observation that it's also fairly inflammatory in its language. Specifically, it mentions heartless and cold decisions and that the Secretary should know awareness or concern. And I'm just curious if that's the kind of strongly worded message we need to send, and if you'd stand by that.
Well, Representative Kawasaki, I have used those exact terms. I have called her decision heartless because I truly believe that the decision that she has made was without consideration for the people that live there. And that troubles me. It troubles me greatly. And particularly the Secretary of the Interior, who has a trust responsibility to our Native peoples. So, I mean, you are right, you are correct to point out that there is language in this resolution that is very direct, and that the Secretary probably would not like to see, but I believe that we must be very clear and really state in no uncertain terms that as Alaskans we feel very strongly that this is a decision that should not be allowed to stand, because it does go directly to the safety of the people who live out there. And I think that is probably a subject for your committee there to look critically at those words. I stand behind the words that I have used. You all need to, as legislators for the state, you all need to make sure that you can stand behind the words as well. But I have been, I think you know this, given my comments that I made when I addressed the legislature in February. To me, this is not an issue where we can find something else that the Secretary can give to Alaska to make us happy and make this issue go away. You cannot trade the health and safety of human beings for another project. This is not a project. This is about lives of people in a very, very remote part of the United States of America. But they are in the United States of America, and we have an obligation to, where possible, allow for a level of safety and ways to improve the quality of people's lives. And I have told the Secretary directly that I do not intend to back down off this. I think Alaskans agree that a road is the right decision. How we state our case is going to be important, and I appreciate the fact that as lawmakers you are willing to advance a resolution that is as detailed as this, and as direct as it is.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, his question.
Thank you. Thank you for calling in, Senator. Are we focusing our venom on the right person? I mean, is this Secretary Jewell's call? Is this coming from the administration? I mean, is this, where does this come from? There's no logic to me that would, you know, that one person would be able to stand in the way. So can you help me understand the process?
Sure. In terms of where the decision currently resides, there has been a request for reconsideration of the Secretary's determination. So that clearly rests with the Secretary at this moment. She was the one that was given authority, if you will, in the 2009 legislation to make that best interest determination. So in fairness, in terms of where the decision lies, it does rest with the secretary. Now, you ask a good question in terms of whether or not it is being directed from the White House. I have used every tool available to me to make sure that people in this administration understand this issue and how it relates to us in Alaska. I have had repeated conversations with the Vice President just to make sure that he was aware of where this issue rested and where Alaskans were coming down on it. I do believe that if the Secretary made the decision to reconsider, that it would be done. I don't think that it hurts that this resolution is directed to the President of the United States as well as the Secretary of Interior, but I do think that ultimately this decision will be made by Sally Jewell.
Good deal. Senator, thank you very much. I want to thank you for taking time late in your day, having been back east as well. I understand what time it is back there and how much you've gone through to get to this point in your day. Your position on the issue is clear. I think this resolution states our position fairly clearly as well, so we're glad to support you. My intent would be to move through the public testimony towards a vote, if possible, on this resolution today. So with that, I want to continue public testimony and ask the gentleman who are online from King Cove to testify. Keep it brief as you can. So, Mr. Henry Mack of King Cove, if you're online, can you give us your name for the record and give us your testimony?
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Sadler and Feige and members of the House Resort Committee. My name is Henry Mack. I'm the mayor of the city of King Cove and a lifelong resident. Thank you for this opportunity today to comment on House Joint Resolution 30. I want to give my thanks for the overwhelming support of the Alaska Legislature of the Eisenbach Land Exchange leading to the approval of the one-lane gravel road connecting King Cove to the Cove Bay Airport. I also wish to acknowledge Representative Herron, who is the author of this resolution and spending considerable time in King Cove the last few years, becoming very familiar with King Cove's transportation access issues. This approval process has been a long time in the making. I was on the City Council back in 1976 when we adopted our first resolution identifying the need for this road to access to Cold Bay Airport. Since that time, 12 people have been killed flying in and out of King Cove. Countless other relatives and friends have had their lives impacted being medevaced out of King Cove. I just can't believe we are still dealing with the federal government over this basic quality of life issues for our residents. When the incredible offer to trade over 60,000 acres of state and King Cove Corporation lands to the federal government for 206 acres of the Eisenbach land so that we can have 9 miles one-lane road access to the Cold Bay Airport. Then 2 days before Christmas, Sally Jewell said no, as you would expect. The entire community was and still is outraged. Her decision, quite honestly, implies that the lives of our residents are not very important to her or the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Adding further insult to her decision was the very flawed and biased EIS, which the federal government has used to justify this unbelievable decision. Secretary Jewell has further insulted us by saying that the marine landing craft could work better than a road in the transportation of our sick and injured residents to Cold Bay. This position shows absolutely no federal government awareness of the extreme weather and marine navigational issues at the western end of the Alaska Peninsula. The Secretary's decision is one of the most recent and extreme examples of federal government overreach in Alaska. This decision is also a major culture insult to our prominently valued residents of King Cove, since it completely has ignored the government's trust responsibility to fairly listen and include our expectations and concerns when decisions are getting made about our lives. We have asked Secretary Jules to reconsider her decision. So far, she has not responded to our request, which we made in mid-January. Please know I have personally told the Secretary and her staff at U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that we will never go away until the right decision is made on this matter. In closing, I respectfully ask you to approve this resolution. It clearly expresses our needs, frustrations, emotions, and expectations on this critical issue to all residents of King Cove. And thank you again to the Alaska State Legislature and Governor Parnell's administration for standing strong and committed with us to this very critical Eisenbach issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Henry Mack of King Cove. Given the time we have, is there anybody else at King Cove that wants to add to the mayor's remarks, or can we let them stand for themselves?
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Hearing no one else from King Cove, I'll go to Palmer and ask Mr. Mike Coons to give us your name and the record and give us your very brief testimony, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Representative Zeidler and the committee. My name is Mike Coons from Palmer, and I'm speaking for myself and as a director for Citizens Initiative. On 4 March this year, I gave a presentation on Eisenbach land fiasco, which can be listened to at patriotsride.org. This link is in my written testimony that I have submitted to the committee. This presentation was nationwide, and I do hope when you listen to it that I represented Alaska, our concerns and outrage of what Secretary of Interior has done, well and true. That said, I, as an Alaskan, am frustrated by a federal government who is more concerned with the politics and animals versus that of Alaskans and Americans. I am also frustrated by the fact that for so many times, resolutions from this body to the Congress are filed, may be read by a very few and forgotten. During this last almost 2 years that I've been able to really watch and participate in this legislature, I have yet to see a single resolution have any impact on Congress to the advantage of our state. Citizens Initiatives has a constitutional amendment which we support and wish to put forward in a call for a convention of the states through Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution. Sadly, I've not been able to get that forwarded through this session. However, I do plan to work hard to get it introduced and passed in 2015. That said, this amendment is called the Countermand Amendment and would, upon passage, give the ability for 60% of the states to countermand actions like Secretary Jewell. This one amendment would put our state and the majority of freedom-loving states in the driver's seat and make these resolutions no longer needed. This amendment would return to the states the sovereignty and power over that of an overreaching and blind federal government. For now, I must support resolutions like this one, because it is all we have for now. I ask that all listening go to our website, read the proposed amendment, and get with me to support or ask questions on this direction, amendment, and future Article 5 call. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coons. I appreciate your testimony. Is there anybody else online wishing to testify? Okay. Good. I guess we'll go back to King Cove to see if the folks there have a brief testimony they'd like to present to us. Mr. Mack or Mr. Hennig? Can the folks in King Cove hear us still? Gary Hennig or Stanley Mack?
Stanley Mack here at the city of Sand Point.
If you have brief comments, sir, please let them know.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the House Resource Committee. My name is Stanley Mack. I'm the mayor of the Aleutians East Borough. Mayor Henry Mack is my nephew, and I was also born in King Cove, and I now live in Sandpoint. I've been a fisherman out there for 60 years, and I was here. I also want to thank you folks for this opportunity to testify on House Resolution, Joint Resolution 30. Thank you also for your strong report and consistent support for the issue. And I also wish to acknowledge Representative Heron and his personal advocacy and understanding of this issue. The Eisenbeck land exchange will allow for a one-lane gravel road so that the 950 residents of Cane Cove can finally reach a safe and dependable access to Cold Bay Airport. Like Henry Mack, I was appalled and angered with Secretary Jewell's decision 2 days before Christmas, although I understand that and there was a daily challenge of transportation access in rural Alaska, being the mayor of the East Borough. It's one of my charges. I also realize that it's not always, not all of these transportation challenges can be resolved here in the East Borough and elsewhere around the state. We all know the variable weather, topography, patterns of human settlement, and money will always continue to make transportation accessible a major challenge throughout many parts of Alaska. However, the Cane Cove transportation access problem is different. This can be solved. That is why we have been persistent for so long. Of course, you know about the unprecedented land exchange, 60,000 acres for 200 acres. It's just appalling.
Mr. Mack, if I could, sir, with your indulgence, sir, we do have your written testimony. We are primed for a vote on this resolution, so if you would like to wrap up your testimony.
Certainly. I just want to thank you folks for the the legislature and the governor for standing so strong and committed to us in a very controversial issue.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mack. I appreciate your testimony. Last chance, Gary Hennick, if you have anything to add, sir.
Mr. Chair, no, I gave way to the two Mayor Macks. They have summarized it nicely, so thank you for checking with me, though.
Thank you very much, Gary. I appreciate that. See anybody else in the room who would like to testify? With that, we'll close public testimony and ask the will of the committee. Representative Peggy Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move and ask unanimous consent, or I move that we pass this House Joint Resolution number 30-28-LS-1533 /A out of committee with individual recommendations.
And
zero fiscal note.
That's the motion. Any objection? With that, it passes out. It's 3:01. We are adjourned. We'll meet on Wednesday. Thanks.